Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the LaRouche Show. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the Economics Section of Executive Intelligence Review, and I will host today's show. As you know, we're weekly from 3 to 4, live on the Internet on our website, LaRouchePub.com, and our theme for today, March 3rd, 2007, our general theme is globalization. You could also use its other name, imperialism, and our focus, however, for this is the situation in Africa. And we are very pleased that we have as our special guest today the Honorable Ambassador from Zimbabwe, and we welcome on the show Dr. Machivanyika J. Maporanga. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you very much indeed. It's Machivanyika T. Maporanga.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And the Ambassador is speaking with us from the Washington, D.C. area, and we have off-site two people in our discussion today. Nearby in Baltimore, Larry Freeman, who for EIR is our Africa desk and very active on many topics. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you very much, Marcia. Glad to be here.
And also in the United States, but on the Pacific Coast, a leader in the LaRouche youth movement nationally and internationally, we welcome from Oakland, California, Mr. Summer Shields. Hi, Summer.
Hi, Marcia. Thank you very much.
And so I want to make just one announcement, and then we'll get right down to it, because as I said, globalization, you could also call it imperialism, and it doesn't mean it's doing well. It is very much alive, and for the last 40 or so years, globalization under its many names has been taking down nations and causing increasing harm. I say many names. It's gone as free trade, global sourcing for food. It was called 30, 40 years ago in the United States post-industrialism, and among its most, I think it's one of its most evil names, is it goes under the name of environmentalism by saying too many people are causing too much economic activity, which is causing greenhouse gases, which is hurting our planet. You know what I'm talking about when it comes to saying that human activity is overheating Mother Earth. And I want to underscore that there's a very special event coming up March 7th, that's Wednesday, and at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, there will be a Washington, D.C.-based international webcast by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche, and its general title could be called Implications of the Al Gore Hoax for International Policy. You could leave off Al. It's a gory hoax for international policy. And so this, with that, I'm just referring to the fact that we have the characteristics of the globalization that we face today is such that it's reached the stage of extreme financial bubbles, cartel control, immiseration, and harm, as we see in the continent of Africa and elsewhere in the world, that's reached the stage where it's breaking apart, and we're either going to have worse chaos and a dark age, all to serve some private financial interests, manipulating this in the background, who've always been anti-nation state. Or we're going to be able to turn the situation around in the coming weeks, months, and not longer than a year or so. And so we're going to take a very positive approach. And from that point of view, I'm so glad that we could have Dr. Maporanga with us. And Larry Freeman, I wonder if you want to start the discussion in any respect of the situation in Africa and globalization.
I'd be happy to. I'm very happy to have my friend Dr. Maporanga, the ambassador from Zimbabwe, on this show. I'm pretty sure you're the first ambassador to appear on the LaRouche show, so you may start
That's
a
true.
New trend in our coverage here in the United States and around the world. The first thing I'd like to discuss with you, Mr. Ambassador, is the American public is fairly ignorant of history in general, even our own, but they really have very, very little understanding of the history of the formation of African nations in their fights against imperialism. I believe that Zimbabwe is the youngest or maybe the second youngest nation in Africa having come into its independence, I believe, in 1980. And I was wondering if you could give our listeners a history of the struggle. It was a very intense struggle against colonialist forces, and I think it was a very important victory for Africans and for the whole world that Zimbabwe emerged as a nation state, I guess, almost about 27 years ago. So if you could fill us in on some of that history, I think that would be a very good way to begin.
Yes, I will. Thank you very much for this invitation to participate in this program. And I am flattered that I'm the first ambassador to participate in this very important forum. Now, concerning Zimbabwe, which used to be called Rhodesia, because it was colonized by Cecil John Rhodes, a man who used to be prime minister in the Cape Province of South Africa, and he's the one who organized an army to invade Zimbabwe and conquer it, and so that it became part of Her Majesty Queen Victoria's empire. Now, Zimbabwe, or Rhodesia then, was in a unique position, largely because of the known mineral reserves or resources, as well as the very temperate climate. That made Rhodesia and South Africa, if you go through the Public Record Office at Kew Gardens in London, where the Colonial Office papers are kept, you see that they are referred to as, and the phrase that is used is, white man's country, which means that Rhodesia and South Africa and what were referred to then as the White Highlands in Kenya, those three, throughout Africa, they were earmarked for permanent white settlement, and when they write about white men's country, they were referring to the White Highlands of Kenya, Rhodesia and South Africa, as well as Australia and in New Zealand. And that policy, that colonial policy of white man's country, actually rested on two pillars. The first one being what you might call demographic change, meaning that the white authorities had as their major agenda to redress the population ratio between the indigenous folks and the incoming white settlers. In the case of Zimbabwe, for example, in 1894, the British South Africa Company, which was administering that territory, reported that for every one white man, there were 19,000 natives. And but by the time that we had the peak of white settlement during the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, which comprised what is now Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Malawi, that ratio had been altered to 1 to 13. From 1 to 19,000 to 1 to 13, or 1-3. And in the case of South Africa, when the Dutch East India Company first arrived, they were reporting that the ratio between them and the natives was something like one white man to 27,000 natives. But as we speak to, now on this program, the ratio is now 1 to 10. So in all these countries that were labeled white man's country, that was part of the policy to reduce the population ratio between the whites and the natives. The second pillar of that policy was land alienation. And in all these countries, there was a deliberate policy to alienate vast tracts of land for settlement by the white immigrants, and the native population was herded into, in Zimbabwe, they were called native reserves. In South Africa, they were called Bantustans. I don't know what they were called in Australia and New Zealand. But to the extent that by the time that we in Zimbabwe gained our independence in 1980, 75% of arable land was in white hands, and the indigenous folks had only 25% of the of the land. And this is why I'm saying this, because in most African countries, and this week we will be celebrating the independence of Ghana, the first country to win independence south of the Sahara. In all these countries, it did not take an armed struggle. There were just negotiations, and maybe after a few demonstrations and strikes and so forth, and they were granted their independence, except, of course, in the case of Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau. These were Portuguese colonies, which Portugal was saying, they are not colonies. This is Portugal overseas, and therefore inseparable from Portugal. And so the people of Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau were forced to embark on a protracted armed struggle before they won their liberation. Now, in the case of Zimbabwe, the leader of the white population there, a gentleman known as Ian Smith, had sworn that there would be no democracy in Zimbabwe for 1,000 years. And this is why, because there were no democratic avenues to the exercise of our human rights, the Africans had to form a liberation army and win their independence after 14 years of bitter struggle. So basically, that is the situation that the first democratically elected government in 1980, and these were elections organized and supervised by the British governor there. The British had restored their sovereignty over the territory because the settler population had rebelled against the British crown since the British were insisting that there has to be that the franchise had to be extended to the natives, and there was resistance, and therefore they declared independence unilaterally in 1965 to ward off any possibility of a democratic dispensation. So at the end of the war, there was a peace conference that was held at Lancaster House in London, at which the then Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher of the Conservative Party, promised, because there had been a deadlock over the question of land. The African nationalists were saying, no, we cannot buy land from the white farmers to distribute to landless blacks, because the land had not been bought in the first place from our ancestors. It was merely grabbed as booty, conquest booty. So at the end of the conference, it was agreed that the British government would help fund the land reform program to ensure a more equitable redistribution of land. But and indeed, Margaret Thatcher put some funds into the project to kickstart it, but in as you probably know, in 1995, the Conservative Party was booted out of office, and Tony Blair and the new Labour Party came in, and the sad part of it was that a letter was written to the government of Zimbabwe to say that the new Labour Party is not beholden to the promises made by the Conservative Party, and the British government stopped funding the land reform program, and the government in Harare in Zimbabwe was constrained to go to Parliament to pass enabling legislation to empower the government to procure land for redistribution to the landless.
Yes, I wanted to follow up with that. I just would add to your earlier comments that Cecil Rhodes is identified as the number one staunchest supporter of the British Empire, of the Imperial British Empire. And this is identified, for example, by Carol Quigley in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment. So you're dealing with the most beyond conservative. You'd only be able to describe the people around Cecil Rhodes as the most hardcore imperialist supporters of the empire, and that is who President Mugabe and the Zimbabwean people were essentially fighting against the continuation of that for what I understand is 14 or 15 years of very intense guerrilla warfare, which was only one generation ago, really. But to follow up where you left off on this question of the land issue, because I think it was probably around 2000, maybe 2001, that President Mugabe started to redress this land injustice, because I believe you had something like 4,500 white British Rhodesian farmers controlling 70% of the prime agricultural land. And this was supposed to be, as you said, Lancaster House, turned over to about 12 million black Zimbabweans, and it wasn't. So President Mugabe started to take the land and give it back to the people. And this caused, I think, one of the biggest confrontations that Zimbabwe had with the world, and I think a lot of attacks on President Mugabe came from this. And maybe you could describe to us how this came about and how it was, and how the distribution took place.
Yes. So, as I was continuing to say, the enabling legislation was passed, the Land Appropriation Act, and even the Constitution had to be amended to enable the government to appropriate land legally for redistribution in order to redress this this imbalance inherited from the colonial regime. But I wish to say that when that happened, that was really 20 years after independence, because the first 10 years, the government's hands were tied. The Lancaster House Agreement stipulated that in order to you know, to maintain the confidence of the white farmers, who were the bastion of the agro-based economy of the country, that there should be no forcible land appropriations for the first 10 years. This was part of the Lancaster House Agreement, and it was called an entrenched clause in the Constitution. The other entrenched clause being that for 10 years there had to be 20 seats reserved for the white population in the parliament. These would not be subject to contest by the indigenous population. Again, it was meant to be a confidence-building measure. Now, and after the 10 years had elapsed, still there was no progress on the front of land reform, because the principle that had been agreed to, and the government was meticulously following the agreement, was that of willing seller and willing buyer. meaning that the government was precluded from seizing land. The market forces should play out in this area, that if there are willing sellers and willing buyers, that this imbalance would be redressed with time, with the passage of time. But so another 15 or almost 20 years passed, and very little progress was made using the principle of willing seller, willing buyer. Incidentally, this was also the principle that was enshrined in the resolution of the Namibia problem. When Namibia gained its independence in 1990, they also adopted that principle. And as you know, recently the government of Namibia has declared that this principle has failed to redress this imbalance in land ownership in Namibia, and the government has now started to appropriate land through the passing of laws, and this is happening also in South Africa. South Africa also, they have just discovered that the willing seller, willing buyer principle does not work, and last year the government made its first appropriation of a white farm or white farms for redistribution to the landless. So, but when this started, we started to seize land for redistribution. We earned the wrath of the British government, and they persuaded their allies, including the United States, to impose sanctions on the Zimbabwean government. And the nature of these sanctions are in two parts. First, there is an executive order which was passed by the president here, which lists Zimbabwean leaders who are barred from entering the United States. And we have a similar list of leaders who cannot go into the European Union. But that one does not really hurt. What really hurts is the second part of the sanctions package. This I'm referring in the case of the United States to the 2001 Act by Congress, which instructed the Secretary of Finance to in turn instruct all American executive directors of the Bretton Woods institutions, i.e. the World Bank and the IMF, and wherever they may be, even in the private sector, to bar Zimbabwean access to capital, to credit, and to oppose any debt relief measures being extended to Zimbabwe. And this is what has really had a very adverse effect on the Zimbabwean economy. Without the imprimatur of the IMF, you cannot raise any loans abroad, especially in the Western world. And Zimbabwe, since 2001, has been completely starved of foreign credit, and this has impinged adversely on the economy. The economy right now is in the doldrums, and we would want the people of the United States to ask Congress to reconsider, because this is a blunt instrument which is affecting the children, the women, and everybody in Zimbabwe in terms of a shrinking economy and people not being able to find employment. And I'm told we have the highest inflationary rate at the moment. Now, that just goes to show that when you have an economy which is deeply embedded in the old imperial economy, it is very vulnerable. And we have, it is, in the case of Zimbabwe, it has been proven beyond doubt that what Marshall was talking about imperialism being equal to globalization. This is a classic case of a third world country inheriting an economy that was fashioned by the imperial power and is an integral part of that of the imperial power, and is unable to extricate itself from that, and therefore being in a very vulnerable situation indeed. That's what I wanted to say at this juncture.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Ambassador, let me also say the LaRouche Youth Movement person I mentioned, Mr. Paul Moreno, who's based in Washington, D.C., has just joined us and has been following somewhat all your history and in the current policies of these sanctions and so forth. And both he and Summer had raised before the show the question, or a question in their minds that might concern Cecil Rhodes. If you don't mind taking a couple of historical questions now, they could ask you.
Yes, please.
Oh, hello, Mr. Ambassador. So I'd like to let you know that we've been studying the question of the Anglo-American establishment as a historical phenomenon. Most people in our generation don't recognize what the British really are or have done. When people think of Cecil Rhodes, they think of this great scholarship that you could get if you are the right person in the right place. But anyway, we are revisiting that material now around him because these particular political networks are now showing up as major backers behind the return of Al Gore. So I wanted to know if you could speak a little bit about this character's role in what he did in Africa, because most people don't know a lot of the details.
Yes, Cecil John Rhodes was an invalid who could not stand the cold climb, the weather of Britain, and he migrated. He said he would go to Africa to where the climate was warm, and he went to South Africa and got involved in the mining. He formed a company called the British South Africa Company, and got involved in the mining of diamonds in Kimberley and other places. And in no time at all, he had become the richest and therefore the most powerful man in South Africa. He even became the prime minister of the largest state there, the Cape, what is known was known then as the Cape Province. And he said that the greatest thing that can happen, that would have happened to anybody in the world, was to have been born British. And he said his life's ambition was to spread Her Majesty's domains from Cape to Cairo. That's the phrase he used. Cape to Cairo, and the South Africa having been secured for the British, he organized an invasion force. He called it the Pioneer Column, which crossed the Limpopo River, which was then the border of South Africa, to invade the lands to the north. And he managed to extend the British Empire to what is now known as Zimbabwe and Zambia, across the Zambezi River, and Malawi, which he called Nyasaland. So southern Rhodesia, that is Zimbabwe, northern Rhodesia, which is Zambia now, and Nyasaland. Eventually, these three territories formed what was known as a federation, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. And he, just 6 years after the invasion and the occupation of Zimbabwe, there was a nationwide insurgency, and he personally came to supervise the war against the insurgency. And he managed to talk with some of the tribal chiefs and leaders, and eventually the insurgency was defeated. And he wrote in his testament that he would want to be buried in this magnificent land called, which was named after his name, Rhodesia. And to this day, his tomb is there at the great, at the Matopo Hills, just outside the city of Bulawayo. He called it the world's view. He said there's no place that is as beautiful as this in the entire world, and I want to be buried here. And he was indeed buried there. And even after independence, we elected to respect his wishes. We do not commit what amounts to sacrilege by we let the dead sleep in total rest. So even as we speak now, Cecil John Rhodes is buried in Zimbabwe.
Gentlemen, I must break for just a very short program announcement, and then we'll continue. Perhaps we can go on to Summer, who likewise had questions along these lines. But you are listening March 3rd, 2007, to the weekly LaRouche Show. We are from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. As you know, on the website of the Executive Intelligence Review publication, which is www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. And I, as this interchange so far has been making clear, this is need-to-know information about the real nature of this globalization, in fact, empire economics, which is now both causing such harm and also cracking up, so it's time we can do something about it, long overdue. And I give you a phone number, toll-free for those in the United States, to also call besides we use the website. It's 800-929-7566, 800-929-7566. And finally, the reminder again, watch for March 7th, the international webcast that's being given by Lyndon LaRouche, based out of Washington, D.C., on Wednesday, that day, at 1 p.m. And that you can find on the website of the LaRouche Political Action Committee. That's LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouchePAC.com. And now we return again with our discussion with our honored guest, the ambassador from Zimbabwe, and Dr. Mapuranga, and our panelists also. Is it Summer Shields? I wondered if you wanted to put in a question or comment at this point from Oakland.
Yes, I did, actually. Dr. Mapuranga, concerning the shocking revelation that most university students would, at least a revelation that most university students would find shocking, that somehow with the liberation of these African nations, merely at the end of the 20th century, as an obvious case in point, that you would have a continuation of the same type of imperial policies that ravage much of the planet, especially centered in Britain, that you would have a continuation of that today in the guise of globalization. Would you say, in your own opinion, that globalization is a continuation of this same sort of policy? And I also just wanted to bring up the case of both Bush and Cheney and the obvious subversion of the political atmosphere as of recent, which you may or may not comment on. And secondly, the case of Al Gore and the promotion of the global warming as an intended goal of a deindustrialization of a planet which is already deindustrialized. And I got a chance, and I was very happy to do it, see firsthand the kind of deindustrialization that's taken place through the fraudulent claim that somehow human beings are destroying Mother Earth or something like that. But I was wondering if you could comment on globalization and that.
Yes. In the case of the Zimbabwean, or indeed the African experience, Well, I know that globalization is being used to denote process that has been happening in maybe in the last 10 to 15 years as a result of the enormous advances that have been made in transport and communications, the internet and so forth. But one could indeed say, as an African, that when you consider the fact that my country, Zimbabwe, had never had any what you might call relations with Europe for the last, since Cecil John Rhodes came, one would say that being integrated into the British Empire and losing one's sovereignty would classify that kind of action as part of the globalization process. I know that this argument has been made even with respect to the discovery of the New World and their integration into part of the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, and the Portuguese Empire, and that these territories, which were having their own civilizations in their own right, had now become part of the European world. That also has in some cases been referred to as the origins of globalization. But in the case of Africa, I would say that yes, indeed, after independence, Africans did discover that their economies were appendages of the economies of their imperial masters. The Mozambican economy, the Angolan economy, they discovered that at the time of independence, they were just adjuncts or appendages of the Portuguese economy, and they were also part of the multinational or transnational corporations' domain of power and influence. And therefore, that the concept of sovereignty or national sovereignty was really circumscribed by the fact that economically, even though they now had their own flag and national anthem, economically they found themselves still dependent on the former colonial masters, largely because we are talking of pre-industrial economies here, economies that were fashioned to provide raw materials and primary products to feed the industries in the metropolitan or imperial countries. So to this day, and I'm talking of Africa south of the Sahara, and that I know very well, we are talking of a whole subcontinent that is still in its pre-industrial phase. We still have to go through an industrial revolution, and what is happening now with this thrust for globalization and liberalization, we have very weak economies here that are agro-based, just entirely based on agriculture, with very little, and in some countries, no industry at all. And the traditional role is still continuing, that of providing cheap material for the factories and industries of Europe and maybe North America. And it is quite easy to see that globalization here tends to solidify this situation of subservience, economic subservience and dependency, because you cannot have equality in competition between industrialized giants and agricultural peasant economies. So this is basically how I see the situation. And I had not looked at the Al Gore project as one of deindustrialization. I would have thought that those who make the final decisions, particularly in the World Trade Organization, and I'm thinking here of the Doha Round and so forth, they would take cognizance of the fact that those countries that are still trading in primary commodities, in raw materials, without any value added to them, because they are in a pre-industrial age, that they would be given special consideration to allow them to industrialize, even using the traditional forms of energy that are being blamed for the greenhouse effect and therefore for global warming. But if there is not going to be any special consideration to these countries, then it is unfair, because they how are they going to industrialize? It's like someone who has already industrialized saying, please, you cannot use these traditional forms of fuel because they are polluting the atmosphere. You have to look for other forms of fuel to for your industrialization. I think that is basically unfair. There has to be a special understanding or dispensation there. This is what I wanted to say by initial reaction to the question posed.
Oh, thank you. Is there more from that, or Larry, do you want to bring something else out?
I think also the ambassador touched on this question of the role of these global financial institutions, including, I mentioned, the IMF. And I think if the ambassador could tell us about the situation in Zimbabwe there, the IMF tried to force the Zimbabwe economy, I believe, to accept economic structural adjustment program in 1990, which was a mere 10 years after independence. And this was a policy for trade liberalization, globalization, attempted privatization of state industry. And I believe by the end of the 1990s, the Zimbabwe government refused to carry out this structural adjustment program, and was, as the ambassador said, was severely penalized, I believe, with a shortage of credit and a complete isolation. And if Ambassador Maparana could tell us a little bit about how these global financial institutions can destroy and isolate an economy, that I think is part of this globalization policy today.
Yes. The unfortunate thing about the IMF is that they seem to believe that they have the panacea to the economic wars of the developing countries. The IMF seems to have just one prescription for whatever the disease may be. Basically, the major elements in the IMF in an IMF structural adjustment program is that the government must cut down on expenditure on social, in the social sphere, that's education, health, and housing, and so forth, in order to reduce government expenditure and therefore to be able to service debts and hopefully have whatever is left over for reinvestment for economic growth. But the problem is that in Africa is the most backward in terms of education and health and housing and other social services. And I think the economists of development have emphasized the importance of the human factor in development. If you do not develop, if you don't have an educated and healthy population, it's not easy to undertake a national development at all. Zimbabwe, which you mentioned, actually we for a long time we ignored the dictates of the IMF, and we spent a lot on education and health to the extent that Zimbabwe today, with 91% literacy, it has the highest literacy rate in Africa. I want you to check that out with the UNICEF, and with UNESCO and the UNDP. At the time that we had only one university at the time of independence, we now have 13 universities within 2 decades. This is tremendous expansion in even in primary and tertiary education as well. Where does this lead us to? Mr. Freeman referred to the Zimbabwean dealings with the IMF. It was only last year that Zimbabwe paid all that it owed the IMF under the general resources account. Zimbabwe does not owe a single dollar now under this general resources account, but we still owe money under a different account. I think it is called it's called the Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility. Yes, PG, Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility. We still owe there something in to the tune of 120 million. But the point is that this matter has been politicized, and this is where people have been accusing the IMF and to some extent the World Bank that they have become tools, political tools for those that control, that have the controlling vote in those institutions, because as it happened last year, and I personally was involved, and I was there in the meeting. The governors or the executive, the governors, all of them, except those from Britain and the United States, they voted to say that Zimbabwe had acquitted itself of the original cause of having that led to its suspension of its voting rights in the IMF, and therefore there was a recommendation by the managing director of the IMF and his staff that Zimbabwe should get back its rights, but this was vetoed by the governor from the United States and the governor from the United Kingdom. A few other governors from Europe abstained, but the vast majority, they voted in favor of the restoration of voting rights. But in the IMF, you have a weighted voting system. not every country as the not every country's vote has the same weight as is the case in the General Assembly of the United Nations. There, it's one country, one vote. But in the IMF, they're the big boys that, if you take the United States, for example, the governor's vote is worth more than that of maybe seven or eight other or eight countries. So because of that, recommendation to restore Zimbabwe's voting rights was timed or vetoed. So, but the point now is that the IMF is not just doing what it was traditionally meant to do, in other words, to give budgetary support to those who need it. They have waded into the area of policy. They actually dictate now to the recipients of those or applicants for loans what policies they should pursue, what economic policies they should pursue, and of course one of them being to open up, to liberalize, and you can see that when you have a country that is trying to create rudimentary industry, a country that is incipient industrialization, and you open up and your young industry is not protected from competition from the already industrialized, that really leads to deindustrialization, and this, unfortunately, this is what is happening in Africa now. The little industry that had emerged is under threat of total dismantlement as a result of liberalization and globalization, and which is the doctrine that is preached by the IMF.
Thank you. Paul has an additional question along these lines.
Oh, yes. No, thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I guess you could say we as Americans, we're dealing with a double-edged problem where we're trying to reindustrialize our own domestic economy while at the same time then making a foreign policy that corresponds to that perspective for us and our neighbors. And in the recent period, we're running into a problem, I think, especially in the campuses, in really understanding globalization, but even more specifically, the role that the Commonwealth plays in global political international affairs, and also how this overlaps with certain British education systems, because a lot of the people that carry out policy of globalization or deindustrialization tend to come out of some of these specific British education institutions, like the London School of Economics and others. So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a perspective in how you deal with this from Zimbabwe, and that way, in our organizing, we can have a fresh idea of what we're looking at.
Yes. Well, the Commonwealth really used to be the British Empire, and at one point it was called the British Commonwealth, until the emergence of republics in Africa, and they started to question why they should continue to be referred to be part of the British Commonwealth when, in fact, they had their own national anthems, their own flags, presumably their own sovereignty. So the British was dropped. It is now just referred to as the Commonwealth. I would like to say that originally the Commonwealth used to, well, I'm talking of the mother of the Commonwealth, that is Great Britain, the United Kingdom, used to use the Commonwealth to give economic assistance to members of the Commonwealth, but I was surprised when I attended the last meeting of the Commonwealth in in Brisbane, and that was in 2000, was it 2002? They have now changed the remit or the mandate of the Commonwealth. There is very little by way of economic assistance now. They are now concentrating on what they called, using what they called the principle of a comparative advantage. They're saying that matters pertaining to economic and financial assistance should be referred to the Bretton Woods institutions, and the Commonwealth must do what it does best or better, and that is to ensure that there is democracy, human rights, the rule of law in the countries that are members of the Commonwealth. And there's nothing wrong with that, because all the members agreed to that document. It is called the Harare Declaration, setting out the political values that the Commonwealth has members have to uphold, and they all agreed in their sovereignty. But in actual practice, it seems as though that document from time to time is actually used to advance the political interests of the United Kingdom, and it has also been demonstrated that even in cases where there is a blatant transgression of that or the values of that document. For example, when an elected government in Pakistan was overthrown by a military leader, Pervez Musharraf, General Musharraf, the British government was expected to react by an imposition of sanctions and expulsion and so forth, and that didn't happen. To this day, the government in Pakistan is regarded as a great ally in the war against terror by Britain and the United States, even though there is no democracy there. So some Commonwealth countries, particularly those in Africa, were beginning to question this as a manifestation of double standards. But the Commonwealth really has very little now by way of economic and political solidarity. Countries vote at the United Nations according to their own dictates, not as a Commonwealth bloc. And the safeguarding of the English language appears to be the major concern now of the Commonwealth, in the same sense that the French have the what they call Francophonie to maintain the heritage of the French colonial language in Africa and elsewhere in the world. But I don't think myself that the Commonwealth now is really a force to reckon with in terms of world politics, particularly in terms of voting patterns at the United Nations or elsewhere. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I'm afraid we're nearing a few seconds to the end. Do you want to wrap up, Larry? I will want to thank people, but do you have a final, very few words?
Well, I thought maybe the ambassador maybe has a statement he'd like to make to the American people, since his country has been so much vilified by the press for standing up to its own sovereignty.
Good. We're running over, but go ahead for a few seconds if you don't think that's too discourteous to ask you, Dr. Maparanga.
Yes, I would like to say that in my travels in the United States, I see that there is a vast reservoir of goodwill from the people of the United States for Africa and for my country. The only problem is with the with Capitol Hill and the White House, and I don't know how the Americans can persuade their legislators and their leaders that a small country in Africa called Zimbabwe is not a threat to the United States of America, not at all, and it does not deserve these sanctions that were imposed to redress a colonial inheritance, particularly in the form of the land apportionment in that country.
Thank you so much. We do look forward to a better world, and very soon. And we appreciate your insights today, Ambassador. Thank you, Dr. Maparanga. Thank you, Summer Shields, Paul Marino, and Larry Freeman. Thank you very much. This is March 3rd, 2007, The LaRouche Show. We close today. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you for participating. And don't forget, March 7th, 1 p.m., the international webcast. And I'm sure Mr. LaRouche will have a lot to say about how we can rid the world of this globalization at that time. It's on www.larouchepack.com. Thank you all very much, and good afternoon.